You are listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.
Thank you. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you so much. How's everyone doing?
Great.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you. I love the setting, which, you know, it looks like a nice party, so that makes me less nervous. Even though I've been talking to audiences large and small all my life, I still get stage fright. I think everybody does. You know, you want everything to go well and you want to say everything you want to say. So I am not in any way more qualified than any other person to stand here and speak to you guys. What I hope to achieve by the end of this talk is a little understanding of what it's like to grow up in chaos and how that has influenced my life, how it's inspired me, and also maybe it'll be a chance for you guys to look at your own lives and your own stories and find the inspiration as well and step up into these leadership roles that you're all working towards. So without any further ado, I would love to get started on a little bit about what Michelle read in my bio. So I found myself about 35 years ago in this region of the world. This is East Africa. For those who are intimidated by the size of Africa, Africa is really, really, really big. And you can find just the U.S. fits a little bit in part of West Africa, and India fits somewhere else, and near Sudan. I mean, Africa is really big. It's not one country, as most people think. But this region, East Africa, is right by the Indian Ocean. And I found myself in this region, in Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, by the coast. I was born right there. And in this region, including the area above it, which is Zanzibar, this whole region, all the way up to Mombasa, Kenya, is a very interesting melting pot. You have cultures from all over coming there. We have the Arabs came in there during the 11th, 12th century. We have traders from all over the world trading and coming here to this area. And so I grew up around multicultural, multiracial people who spoke different languages. And I was born into a family of Muslims, Christians, and traditional African religious beliefs. And shortly after, I was taken to meet my other family in Kenya. My father is Kenyan. My mother is Tanzanian. My father is Kenyan. So about 8 years old, I moved to Kenya, where I met my extended family. My father is from, I'm going to let you guys meet my parents. Those are the people who are responsible for bringing me here. So my father is a 6'6" tall Maasai warrior type. He was educated in the colonial times in the 60s. The British came in there and they changed Africa as it was back then. And then he went to Sandhurst Royal Academy. This is where all the royal people in the Europe take their kids to school for, you know, to learn the military ways. So my dad made it to Sandhurst, which is a big deal, because he had shown exemplary leadership and qualities at a very young age. In fact, those days, they did not let you join the military if you wore glasses. Your vision had to be perfect. And so there was a story that he was allowed because of the other qualities that he had. So here he was a captain. He had just come back to Africa. And my mom is, she's a multiracial, she's half Scottish, half Tanzanian, and there's some Arab influences there. This is the extended family. My dad's parents on his right and my mom's family, parents on her right. And that's the extended family in Kenya. And this is all in the early 70s, 1971. So I'm giving you just an idea, pictorial idea, where, you know, the people who influenced and, you know, these are the people who were around before any of us were born. This wedding happened way before any of my siblings came into the picture. So I found myself in Kenya, this area that I showed you, where I went to school from around 8 years old to 18. And I, because of my dad's military career, we were moving from one place to another place. Are there any military brats in here? So you guys know what that's like. You know what that's like. You know, you're constantly moving from place to place, country to country. But I mostly was educated in Kenya from about 8 years old to 18 for 10 years. And in those years, it was a typical blend of the British education system and the traditional African. You know, the Africans were also imparting their own education values and stuff like that. So, you know, in high school, in primary school, in high schools, we had hierarchies. You know, they chose who was in charge of the class. We call them prefects and monitors. So often I would be asked to do that, to be in charge and let everybody else not make noise and write names. And, you know, I didn't really like that because, you know, everyone at that age, you want to be popular. But, you know, a teacher walks in class and says, hey, I want all the names of the troublemakers, you know, and I was a troublemaker myself. So it was very difficult. But after primary school, when I got to high school, those roles were not coming to my way because as a teenager, things had really changed. Then I got my scholarship, as my bio says. I came to the States when I was about 18, and I was given this leadership scholarship. And it was called the Lutheran Leadership Scholarship. It was an international scholarship, and they picked six people in the world. And you got this big opportunity, everything paid for, academic. It was a very, very huge honor. I wish I had all day to tell you how I got it, but what I just did was followed my instinct. Being myself, I was in an elevator one time, and I met somebody who was part of the school in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and I said hello to him, and he started talking to me. One of the things that you find that are very interesting about me is that I'm willing to talk to anybody who talks to me, on the plane, everywhere, because you just never know what will happen. That's how I got my scholarship. This fellow in the elevator made it possible, gave me the information to apply, and a year later, I was in Iowa. So looking back from, you know, college to where I am now, and being asked to speak at, you know, on leadership at different schools, and part of the requirement for the leadership scholarship was to go to to elementary schools and high schools here in the U.S. to share my story. And every day I'm discovering new things. I'm discovering that all along I've been equipped. So the reason why I brought pictures of my parents, not to just show you how they were such good-looking people. My mom looks scared, though, and my dad looks very happy with himself. But to tell you that I was equipped all along with very good role models who exemplified amazing leadership qualities, even though I didn't think so when I was growing up. My dad lived to about 57 years old. He died in 2001. And he rose up in his ranks up to a brigadier general. So I grew up watching all this up to the time he passed on. He passed on just before my graduation. Talk about perfect timing. And I grew up in the military. I saw people giving him, you know, the salutes and all that. And sometimes as kids, we thought that they were actually saluting us, or, you know, we thought they were, it was actually for us. And he would say, hey, that's for me, not for you guys. You got to work your way up. So that was Dad. And my mom grew up and became a manager for, she studied hotel management in Switzerland. And she managed one of the biggest hotels in Tanzania called the Kilimanjaro Hotel. They're very two different people. My dad was the visionary type. He was 6'6". When he walked into a room, everybody went crazy the same way people go, Obama. You know, he just had this charisma, and he didn't have to say much. You know, he had a, you know, beautiful smile, and he spoke in a very soft voice. He was a visionary type. My mom was very quiet and shy, but she was a manager type. She worked really hard. She didn't like to speak in front of people. She liked to work in the background, but she was such an effective manager. I watched her, and I was fascinated. I said, I wish I have those qualities, because she's the most patient, most just meticulous, you know, detail after detail. My mom to this day, you know, she'll tell you everybody's names and where they were from, and she never forgets those kind of small details. And so when I look back, I say, wow, I've been equipped all along. And just in case none of you have ever thought about that, I want you to think about your own parents. And that's where it really started, this yearning for leadership, because they started that. And in my understanding, every generation comes with a set of things that they, you know, an agenda to accomplish. So with the following generation, that means the kids of each generation, I feel that our jobs is to either upgrade what we've been given or to improve upon. But, you know, when you say improve upon, sometimes that has negative connotations, you know. I mean, there's some things that my parents did that I definitely do differently. But a lot of it is just upgrading what they gave me. And so I'm going to tell you about one more person. I'm one of those lucky individuals who was brought up in this interesting background. This is my stepmother. Her name is Charity. I was also raised by her, and I have to mention her because she was also a very important role model for me when my biological mom was in a different country. I was raised by both mothers, and I was raised by an extended family as well, because that's the African way. My stepmom was a personnel manager of an ice cream company. It's a British ice cream company called Lion's Maid. And she quit that and decided to do her own thing at home. She would make ketchup and distribute to all the restaurants. She would make stuff with her hands, just really inspiring stuff. I find myself doing a lot of the things that she used to do now when I have a lot of free time. I've just started making my own skincare products, like butters in the kitchen, and, you know, all of a sudden now people want them, and soon I'll be launching a skincare line. And she was also the manager type, who was interested in small details and doing things to perfection, didn't like a lot of attention, or didn't have, you know, the qualities of a visionary that were not very obvious. She was inspiring to me in many ways, but I wanted to tell you about her as well. So those are my other role models that I'm talking about. Then we go beyond the family life, and there were people that were around us in Kenya. Are you guys familiar with Wangari Maathai? No? So she, I came to know her when I was in my teens in high school. We had a president that time in Kenya who had ruled almost 24 years. I think it was like as long as from the time I was born to, from the time I was born to the time I finished college, we had one president. And she was a very, very strong force against some of the things that were going on in that government. Her big thing was the environment, and she started a green party, green belt party, to talk about the sustainability of the environment and those kind of things. She planted trees, and for some reason, the government at that time found her a threat. I don't know how. But and in a society where men mostly call the shots, this was a very daring thing to do. And she lived to serve in the government, and received a Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. And she's one of my very, very big inspiring role models. Because at this point in this environment, I'm giving you my cultural perspective. Growing up in this region, again, like I said, there was no equality in gender roles. Politics was just corrupt, and we didn't say much. We were very afraid to speak up. Our parents were afraid they didn't speak up. So to see someone do this and get locked up, and you read about it in the stories, you know, they shape your perspective. There were no other women doing that, but she led this movement, which was quite something. In African society, before colonial rule, we had a structure on leadership. You know, we had the network, which is a council of elders. They were mostly older, you know, like grandparents type. And, you know, we had the chiefs and all that. So there was a structure. By the time the colonial rule came, they had them, but under the government structure of the colonial structure. So it was incorporated. What that did was basically tell us that leadership had to be only given to those who were much older. And what it said to us also was that, you know, the older people, that's how the understanding was, that the older you get, the wiser you get. And that, you know, leadership posts were kept for president, I mean, for the older generation. And so that meant the younger voice was oppressed or kept down. There are a lot of good qualities about this leadership before colonial rule came, but they were hardly experienced because change was happening so fast to post-colonial Africa, you know, and keeping up with the Western world and what else is going on outside. So a lot of these old jewels of wisdom either disappeared or, you know, they just remain in history books. My second cultural role model is Tanzania's first president. They called it Tanganyika back then. This is in the 60s. His name is Julius Nyerere. He was a teacher, and he went to school in Scotland and went back and led his country. He decided that his country would take a different direction and therefore decided to be socialist. He worked with the Chinese, the Russians, and really, really had a vision that was very different from what everybody else was doing in Africa. If you talk to a lot of Tanzanians today, they'll tell you that he messed up their lives and blah, blah, blah. You know, you hear different conflicting stories. But I think he was ahead of his time, as most people we've seen in the past come in and they're misunderstood. I think if he were to return today, he would find some of his ideas being used, and you know, I think that's great. That's why we have these visionaries. They come in and they show us something that's 20 years ahead. I want to play something by him. It's a short clip, audio clip, in one of his speeches. This was a speech on education, and I share it even today because what he's saying is so relevant, especially to you guys here, the role of education. He was a teacher himself. Now, The other fascinating observation that I make is that with every leadership type, whether it's an organization or country or any type of group or institution, the people who hold the leadership roles are usually, they usually come with their own set of expertise, right? So he was a teacher, and he led his country like a classroom, literally. And I think about, you know, even in the presidents we've had here, you know, think about the U.S. and every president you've had. You think of George Bush, you know, what is he, businessman? How did he lead the country? Like a businessman. Barack Obama is a lawyer. What's his main focus? Changing the laws, you know. So with every expertise that you take into any leadership role, you know, you have to realize that you're bringing in that perspective and that structure. And I think that not one is better than the other. You know, it's just, it's really important to recognize that. So I'll play this little audio by Julius Nyerere. It's on education and what he thought was the purpose.
As the purpose of activity, the purpose of development. But man can only liberate himself or develop himself. He cannot be liberated or developed by another. For man makes himself. It is his ability to act deliberately for a self-determined purpose which distinguishes him from other animals. The expansion of his own consciousness and therefore of his own power over himself, over his environment and his society must therefore ultimately be what we mean by development. The same is true of education. Its purpose is the liberation of man from the strains and limitations of ignorance and dependence. Education has to increase men's physical and mental freedom, to increase their control over themselves, their own lives, and the environment in which they live. The ideas imparted by education or released in the mind through education should therefore be liberating ideas. The skills acquired by education should be liberating skills. Nothing else can properly be called education. Any teaching which induces a slave mentality or a sense of impotence is not education at all. It is an attack on the minds of men.
So, first time I heard that, this was a speech he gave in 1978. My mom used to just collect speeches of all the presidents of her country, and they're all very charismatic, amazing speeches, especially by Nyerere. And, you know, she used to talk about him so much that I wanted to really know what this man was about. And that speech on education really, really spoke to me because it made me realize that, you know, there are so many of us who think that today that, you know, well, we go to school, we finish, and we should be equipped to be self-reliant and, you know, all that stuff. But it never really always occurs that way. And Nyerere at this time was telling people that this thing that we've adopted, and he believed that was this was the Western perspective of education, was not really well understood by the African perspective. And he said that it should go far beyond the classroom and really create independent minds and all that. You know, he said education should not just create workers and people who are just happy to hang their certificates on their walls. And so this is some of the stuff that's really, really influenced me. The third person that I found to, you know, show some amazing leadership qualities in my upbringing is a man by the name of Thomas Sankara. He may not be a household name. You know, actually, if you talk to a lot of Africans, they don't really know much about him. But I find him to be in equal stature to Nelson Mandela and all the greats. He was actually a military guy, and he was rising in the ranks, and he took part in a coup. He basically went his way about leadership through resistance in a country called Burkina Faso. He actually renamed the country Burkina Faso. It used to be called the Upper Volta. He renamed it the Land of Upright People. He sought out bringing about equality in the society because he realized that women were really, really not represented in the African society. And, you know, there were issues about polygamy, forced marriages, all these things that are cultural. And he became the first president to elevate women to multiple top government positions, as well as uniting them in the army, recruiting them in the army. He was also very frugal. He got rid of all the fleets of the Mercedes Benzes and all these big cars that politicians were using, and made you guys know what the Renault is? Renault, yeah. He made that the cheapest car available, and he said, you know, all the government people should, the ministers and everyone should just drive humble cars. Why do you need all that? All that other stuff. Reduced his own salary to $450 a month. Yeah. I mean, you know, plus his own personal possessions. Nyerere did the same, by the way. When Nyerere retired, he said he didn't want a mansion. He didn't want anything. So these are people who showed some amazing qualities that I hadn't seen anywhere else. This man here was a threat to not just what was already going on in Africa, but also with the forces that continue to affect Africa. You know, the things that he was promoting were kind of not going where imperialists, so to speak, would want the country to be. There's a very common thing that most Africans will tell you, that Africa in chaos is beneficial to big business. So he was killed in 1987, but he's biggest thing for me is fighting for human rights. And I can see his, he said women have to be included. Inequality can be done away with only by establishing a new society where men and women will also enjoy equal rights. So with all these leaders of such caliber that I have shared with you today, and there are many more, I just can't list all of them, I often wonder, you know, from even though I'm in the States now, and I sit down with different people, and the issue of Africa and corruption and leadership always comes up. And people always ask me, so why does the continent continue to have all these self-serving leaders? Why are we defined by the worst amongst us? And why should we continue to stand in apathy and watch all this happen while the greats, you know, go unnoticed? But my answer has always been that, you know, there's this polarity and duality in our lives, right? Where it seems like there's always old versus young, you know, strong versus weak, and all those polarities. Those in power always tend to be the history writers. They say what's recorded. And the only reason why things haven't changed is that we haven't really acknowledged those who are changing things, the manager type of leaders, you know. People tend to notice the visionary types. And my question to you guys is, what kind of leaders do we need today? So let me kind of involve you guys here. I hope you've been thinking about some of the things I've said and shared about my parents and, you know, my mom and my dad being two different types of leaders. How many types of visionary leaders are in this room? How many of you think you're the visionary types? You know, you work best by inspiring others and having visions of the future. How many people are the visionary types in here? How many are the manager types? You know, the ones who set the structure and work on the details, right? How many do both? Right? Yeah, I think that there are times when we oscillate between the two. And this is where I want to drive the conversation today. That if we see the world as polarized, then there's always going to be one side that's going to tell the story more than the other. But if we combine and integrate the polarities, we actually find something more interesting, just like your parents coming together and you being a product of that is an upgrade. So how can we integrate these types of leadership, and what can we possibly achieve when that integration happens? From my cultural perspective, this is a philosophy that, I don't know, is anybody aware, anybody knows what Ubuntu is here? It's not just the software or... Actually, it's you know, the word is from South Africa, from the Nguni tribe, and it's a philosophy. It means, I am what I am because of who we are, that we are all connected. When the black South Africans and the white South Africans, you know, were going at each other for all those years, there were a few people, leaders in the African society who said, you know, Ubuntu says that if we're suffering, then our oppressors are also suffering, right? So I really, really truly believe in this philosophy, and it has healed that country in ways that are amazing. And the biggest proponent of this philosophy is none other than Nelson Mandela, who you all know about by this time. I didn't want to bring any Nelson Mandela quotes. You know, they were all going crazy during a few months ago on Facebook and everything, but I cannot mention African leadership without Nelson Mandela, but there's something he talks about, Ubuntu, that I want to share with you. Oops. Where is the audio? There you go. Thank you.
Many people regard you as a personification of Ubuntu. What do you understand Ubuntu to be?
In the old days, when we were young, a traveler through a country would stop at a village. And he didn't have to ask for food or for water. Once he stops, the people give him food, entertain him. That is one aspect of Ubuntu, but it will have various aspects. Ubuntu does not mean that people should not address themselves. The question, therefore, is, are you going to do so in order to enable the community around you to be able to improve? These are the important things in life. And if one can do that, you have done something very important which will be appreciated.
Let me remind you guys that Nelson Mandela at first, you know, started as a very radical lawyer type, you know, who was in the resistance movement. And over the span of all those years when he was in prison and when he came out, He adopted Gandhi's nonviolence, you know, approach to leadership, and also the non-ego. I say the non-ego because when you look at any visionary leader who has been able to make, you know, at least to get our attention, it's always been those who have brought people together, very divergent sides, and, you know, Gandhi's role was really difficult to, you know, the religious divide in India at that time, and Pakistan was huge. And then you think about Mandela, he comes out, his people say, well, you know, we've been suffering, and now you're telling us we have to all coexist. What is that about, you know? And to be able to do what he did, to be able to do what Gandhi did, and to so many others that have been in those positions, takes quite a bit. And that's what I want to talk about. Like, how many of us in those situations would be able to rise to the occasion and be able to say, to unite people and be able to really listen to both sides and present solutions to what is needed? So we get to the global perspective, which brings me to my question to you guys here. How many of you feel like the world is very chaotic right now? Yeah? How many of you think that things are getting better? There's actually order and things are getting better? Technology, health, wellness, right? How many people think both are happening? Yeah, right? So I think that both are happening at the same time. And sometimes it's not easy to see order because chaos can be very consuming, and it depends where your attention is. One of the fascinating things I'm coming to learn is how everything that we see is a hologram of memory that's already stored in our DNA. And if whatever you see out there, you know, it's not that you're the only one seeing it, or, you know, there's your own thoughts being reflected, your own life and your reality being reflected, but it's also the collective that's being reflected. And everyone says, oh, you know, if you want to change the world, change you first. It's a really good place to start. But how do we live in these times when there's so much going on? How do we find peace in the chaos? And these are the questions that a lot of us are asking ourselves today. And we see people are very tired of doing things the old way. They are getting very, you know, everyone wants answers. East turns west, black becomes white, wrong becomes right, weak gets stronger. You know, there are all sorts of polarities and things switching around. Technology is moving really fast and we can't even keep up. How do we make sense of these times? The future of humanity appears to be approaching this chaotic stop. There are people predicting that our sustainability is at risk, you know, that there are not enough resources, or people are too unhappy and we don't know, you know, what's going to happen. Times are accelerating. Does anybody feel like time is moving really fast?
Yes.
Yeah? Who feels like everything is normal? I'd really like to see. You know, you wake up, you have breakfast, and then it's time to go to bed, right? It's just so much happening. And many people are spending endless hours discussing solutions on how to sustain humanity and what are we going to do. And my questions have been, what are we going to do? Are we going to continue to fall for the seduction of materialism, war, greed, domination of others? Or are we going to open our eyes and start to live consciously? Are we going to achieve our potential and manifest our destiny, or are we just going to disappear like the dinosaurs? You know, these are the things I think about. One of the fascinating things about the U.S. growing up here since I was 18 is how the culture thrives and things like sports and, you know, debates, political debates, where everything is always dualistic, you know. Either have, oh, that's my team, that's my, I've never really had a team in my life. I wish I had one. I just haven't been able to get to that place. You know, when I watch sports, I always want to see that player who goes beyond their potential, the person who sets a new record. Because I feel like those are the things that sports and games are about. It's not really about winners and losers. You know, at one point, running track, you know, was the record, world record was, you know, 4 minutes or something. And over the years, those have changed. So I'm always very fascinated by the human potential and the human spirit to go beyond. And that's why I feel like in every area where we have this dualistic thing, that maybe the purpose of this dualistic game is to push us to transcend the polarities. The power struggles we have, how do you bring people together when they're fighting over resources and, you know, the current situation we have, the global issues we have, the current American political debate, you know, in every country you go, you know, the economic crisis brings a lot to the table. So this seems to be the theme: competition versus cooperation. So it seems to me like we've played the competition game very well. And when I was growing up in Africa, it was very competitive in school. You know, they posted our grades in front of the school. Everybody saw what you did, you know, on a regular basis. Talk about pressure, you know. And when I came here, you know, it was a total different opposite in college. In fact, I got really lazy because that competition really kept you on your toes. You know, and I found that the American society really, really encouraged the students to speak up for themselves. You know, sometimes speaking up, when I spoke up, it was seen as, you know, being rebellious or defiant. So our voices were really kept down, and the competition and all that stuff drove the way we went about stuff. But what I want to bring you to your attention is that in looking at these polarities and the dualities, that maybe we can change our perspectives as those of us who are interested in leadership and really think about what they are. Because if we're always going to be met with this dualistic nature of things, is it really necessary to choose one or the other? Or is it a good thing to try both? Have you guys heard of the 100th monkey effect? Anybody? So there's this story that I heard it all the time, and I thought, you know, that's interesting. Let me look it up and find out if it's a real story. But there's a story that was popularized by an author called Ken Case about the 100th monkey effect, that some scientists from Japan were studying some monkeys in South America and how they learned a new skill. And when they learned a new skill, let's say maybe cracking a fruit or nut, that after like one or two had learned, then that ability spread to all the other monkeys in the area and even to the ones that in different parts of the world. It's as if something, you know, was sparked. And, you know, I find that very interesting because if there is this web or network between species, interconnectedness, that I believe we human beings have, then it only makes sense that if we approach leadership in the same way, where we learn these skills, you don't really have to have the past, you know, where you have one leader and plenty of followers, but what you end up having is, if all of you guys, like, you know, really followed your potential and you became these great leaders in the world, everyone around you would be inspired and something would be triggered and would have this 100th monkey effect where it just spreads. And that's, I think that's what's happening right now. So it seems like in these changing times, that's what happening, what's happening with a lot of ideas. You know, the internet. I have a lot of creative friends who will tell me, you know, call me and say, hey, I just had this idea for a song, and you won't believe it, I heard it on the radio, they stole my song. You know, stuff like that. Or you think of an idea and you think you're the pioneer, and you find out it's somebody else in another part of the world already has it. That gives me a lot of hope in what we can do as individuals to really push that potential, because then that means if we do our work, then leadership in these changing times would involve a very different approach. The true leadership of these times then would require a leader to follow himself or herself. You know? Dane here is an author of a book called Being You, Changing the World. He says, a true leader is one who follows what they know. And no matter what happens, whether there's a follower or not, follows that knowing and encourages others to follow their knowing and to do the same. And so these are some of the qualities that I am seeing a lot in the new times, where it's not so much about glorifying the ego and wanting to have as many followers, although, you know, social media kind of forces us to do that. How many followers do you have? Ooh, I have followers. Look at me. I am popular. You know, the leadership that's required in these times of a lot of chaos and order are those that, the qualities that would push us to something that's beyond what we have. And it's something that we'll have to transcend both polarities, whatever we've been dealing with before. Before I actually go any further, can I ask you guys to think about some of the leadership qualities that you have. Where did you get those ideas from? This is what a leader is supposed to have. How were you influenced? Can anybody share? Yes?
I would say servant leadership. I think that's the one that I find very close to me, because I think that serving others before yourself is also a way of just giving back and living a selfless life, and also being humble and knowing that a title doesn't mean anything. So what you do with it is what matters.
Right, right, right. Anybody else wants to share? So what he brought up is the self-service versus service to others. How many of you think that the leadership we've had up to this point has been more service to self than service to others. Does anybody believe that we've had more self-serving leaders? And this is a general thing, you know. How about, how many people think that we've had more service to others? How many people think maybe they're both, maybe we need more of service to self? Well, how many of you are here? What are your reasons for getting into leadership? Are they self-service or service to others or both? Anybody care to share?
What I think is that you have to do self-service first, because in order, say like the top of the top athletes, like Roger Federer, Roger Bannister, who broke the 4-minute mark, no one would believe them unless they did something. You know, you can't just be keep talking about what you did when you haven't done anything. You have to have done something, and then people would believe you. So that's how leadership is. If you've done something and then you share it with others and then you teach how you did it, because obviously, say like me and John, right? We took his test. I got a 60, he got 100. Obviously, there's something he's doing that I don't know. So I have to come to him and say, hey, man, how'd you get that 100? So from that point on, everyone's going to be like, hey, John, how'd you get that 100? So from there on, if you're that great, I think everyone's just going to come to you. So, like, that self-service has to come first, because that knowledge will just grab on people, and then that will have you become the leader.
Yeah. Does anybody else want to add something?
Yes, adding to what Jerome was saying. Also, it's life experiences, things that you've gone through in life, where you would be able to help others, the others that you see that are in that position or somewhat a similar position, where they think that they are not able to get out of a situation. When you yourself have been involved in it and have survived and gotten out of it, mm-hmm. because of the support and also because of your will.
Yeah. So what is our definition of service to self? Right? I really like that you brought that topic, because I wanted to talk about these qualities. The leaders of the future are those who are really, really going to focus on a lot of self first before they can get out there. You know, even on the plane, when you're on the plane, you're told, you know, put on your oxygen mask first, and maybe we haven't seen that as service to self. And be able to balance that with service to others. So one of the first qualities that I am very interested in is authenticity. Do your beliefs match your actions? Or, you know, sometimes we walk around thinking, you know, certain thoughts, but our lives don't really match that. And also authenticity means being true to your calling. You know, most people, you guys is in college right now, I don't know if you have experiences already where you know what you want and you know what you're following, what your true calling is, but somehow a lot of people end up doing what they don't like, you know, and life forces circumstances on you. And I'm going to tell you about my experience with that. So I find that this is the most important quality to, you know, pay attention to. Because of so much change, so much is happening, you know, the changes that we are experiencing, I can't even quite summarize them all, but it's going to take a lot of adaptability. I love this quote by Charles Darwin, of course, you know, it's such an ancient quote, but he was really right when he was talking about the animals and the species. We find that if you're able to adapt to the changing times, life gets easier. And what that takes, that means that you are able to make quick decisions and make very difficult decisions very quickly. Emotional intelligence. This is where the self-development and service to self that we were talking about, The first one is self-awareness. If you look at all the great leaders, whether it's CEOs of companies and, you know, visionary leaders and manager types of different companies and corporations, many of them tend to be very self-aware. Eventually, some of them will write books and, you know, share the knowledge. But self-awareness is actually the first form of emotional intelligence. When you meet people who are very self-aware of their weaknesses and their strengths and how they affect others, and that really, really helps in leadership. And the self-confidence is also something we are not taught in schools. These are things that you find a lot of people now rushing to the self-help books and going to coaches and all sorts of places much later. But some people, some cultures allow for this emotional intelligence pretty early. I'll say I'm just getting started, you know, on this journey. But all along, I've had a little success on most of them. And self-management, you know, that's another one we're not taught to do. But I remember when I was about 13 years old, I went to boarding school, and when I went home for the holidays, I always created a schedule, like what we call it, a timetable. For the first 2 weeks, I studied and wanted to be ahead of the class. And I would take 2 weeks for my holiday so that I could do that. I was a little bit of a nerd and competitive, because it was very competitive. So I would create, I mean, at 13 years, instead of playing with my friends, I woke up really early and kind of created a plan, and I followed it. And I've always tried to do that ever since. It really helps in understanding how to assert myself in different environments and how to be at different places and do all the different things that I do, because that structure, no one has to give it to me. I know exactly what I need to do. The other quality is skill development. You know, those leaders who are constantly learning new things. You know, if you think that you know it all because you've attained a certain level of leadership, you might be very surprised. So leadership and learning are indispensable to each other. I really love this quote, you know, you have to be learning. And another thing that I say, you know, that I find in exemplary leadership is people who are willing to have people who are smarter or know more about things than them, you know. So the leaders who want people who will challenge them, you know. So you're not just going around with everyone who says yes, yes, yes. And this integration, this is a quality that I think that the future leaders will really, really have to be able to have, to integrate these polarities we've been talking about. When you step into judgment of one side being wrong and the other side being right, I believe that you lose the opportunity to bring about something greater than the polarity that you have in your hands. So whether it's old versus young, realist versus idealist, you know, self-service versus service to self, there's got to be a balance, or there's got to be an integration. Because one by itself is really not going to finish the job, and you'll just keep repeating the same cycle. And empathy, you know, being able to understand what others are feeling, what are their situations. And having empathy sometimes, I think, really helps, you know, remove boundaries. You know, if you're able to connect with anybody, not just the people you deem worthy, you know, speaking to every person, taking jobs that may not be that glamorous, to understand what it's like for to be a worker, you know, on the field, or all those jobs. When I look at my own background. There are some jobs I've taken that were glamorous and some were really not. And I learned so much more from those that were not glamorous. And that's what I want to say about integration. The previous thing that I was saying is what we term as negative experience, I think, is the lesson. And the positive experience, which is where most of us think we should be going because we've been dealing with so much negativity, the positive is where the reward is. But you cannot have the reward without the lesson. So integration is very, very important in this, in developing these skills. Empathy is, I can't talk enough about that one. And the last one is sacrifice, going beyond the ego. I don't have to tell you too much about the ego, the way the ego has been driving the human experience. And this is a lot to do with the duality or the polarity that we have, which is, in my opinion, it's just a syllabus of the game of life, of learning the lesson and the reward. So going beyond that would require a lot of sacrifice. We have so many problems right now in the world, and we have a lot of solutions. But in order to get to those solutions, the leaders of tomorrow may have to embark on a journey of sacrifice, and sometimes that means doing and saying things that are not very popular. You know, when everybody's going north and you go south, but eventually they get to the end of north and they realize it's a wrong direction. And they come back and, you know, you don't have to be angry that they didn't hear you first. So, in my own journey, to conclude, I've had a lot of opportunities that could have taken me a different direction. My father wanted me to be a lawyer. You know, I have teachers who told me I should have done archaeology and anthropology. When I finished high school, and the way the system in Kenya works is when you finish high school, based on how well you did, they picked for you what you study. So based on what I was so good at, I was called for archaeology and anthropology. You know, so maybe I'd be somewhere in Egypt digging up bones and stuff like that. I think that would be great because I love history. But I decided I really wanted to follow my passions. And at first I thought, you know, that was great. And everyone's like, wow, what are you doing? Oh, performing artists. That's fun. That's like a hobby, right? You know, but, you know, the journey has been nothing short of a roller coaster ride. You know, you get to every milestone, you have to make choices. And some of the biggest choices I've had to make are whether my music is going to be commercial music, you know, and, you know, your message is kind of limited to what can sell and what cannot, your image, you know, images and standards of beauty. I'm not against any of that stuff. I actually listen to commercial music, but I decided that because I'm such a thinker, there were so many things that I wanted to inspire and let people think about, and I wanted to use music as a tool. So I sacrificed that. You know, a lot of people told me, oh, this is not going to work, you know, no one's going to listen to serious music. No one wants to listen. I said, well, you know, I feel like these are the times where if people have been drinking a lot of, like, orange soda and Coke all their lives, all of a sudden, like, organic juice, organic orange juice seems very appealing. And so, you know, that's my take. And I'm like, yeah, you know, the stuff on the radio is great, but so people who want to listen to something else, they'll have the option of listening to my stuff. And it's not really about numbers. It's enough for everybody. There's 7 billion people on this planet. If 1% listened to my music, I think I would have finished my job. So I started this concept theme album about 5 years ago, and I want to share one song with you guys as my time is up. But the song is called Earth Cry. And it's in both English and Swahili. My approach has been to do the bilingual thing, but you'll be able to understand what I'm saying, is being realistic with the world as it is and asking people to come up with, you know, letting people know that there are solutions, but the sacrifice is needed, and that in order to do that, we have to go beyond our ego, wanting to be right or wrong, but merging what's been working and what hasn't been working. Outdated beliefs need to be thrown out, but we don't throw the baby with the bathwater. You know, some ideas from the past are really helpful, and some new ones that we haven't embraced yet would be needed. So it's going to take a lot of sacrifice on our part to fix the situations in all our institutions.
Thank you so much for having me.